RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums and
Beans. So we just did an hour and 5 minutes or so with Dr. Christina Parks. Didn't you love her?
Yeah, she was great.
She is like, she's not really a hidden gem, but she's somewhat hidden because she doesn't get as much attention as like a Dr. McCullough or a Dr. Malone or whatever, but she is brilliant and she knows her stuff. So we talked a lot about naturopathic health and why our body does certain things and vaccine injury and right.
Yeah, I just sent you something there too, Tracy, because we left off talking about comparative studies between those who have never had any vaccines in their life to general health of those who have had vaccines. And I said, as the doctor was saying, it's really stark, the comparison between the two groups of people. And I just sent you a very short documentary. Well, I don't know if you call it a documentary, but a presentation. It's about 15 minutes long. It's by a very small channel on YouTube called Informed Consent Express.
I see it.
I just sent it to you. It's called Do Vaccines Make Us Healthier? And it includes three independent studies that were released in 2020 that compared overall health of vaccinated and unvaccinated people to the and the results are, as they say, striking. So it was the Greg Glasser, the Hooker Miller study, the Lyons Wheeler Thomas study, and the Mawson study. You should definitely pass this along to her. Put it in the show notes. This, when I showed this to Lauren, I put it into my network late night, I think Sunday night rotation a couple of months ago, and Lauren had her mouth just hanging on the floor because.
I wish I was one of those people that had never been vaccinated. I really do. I really do.
I know somebody very close to me that has an opportunity to be that. So I'm just holding the line right here and you got to check this out.
Make her one of the 0.36% of people in the United States that's never been vaccinated.
Oh, they're going to, everything is in this 15 minutes. It'll show you how staggering the number of people are who have gotten shots in this country. We are not an anti-vax country. There are less than 1 million people who have never had a shot in their lives.
I'm looking at it right here. The percentage of vaccinated Americans is approximately 99.74%.
Yep.
So yeah, anti-vaxxers, my behind, at least at one point in time. I wear that label proudly now. I don't care. I really don't. People use it like she had mentioned in our interview as a pejorative, but before we go into the interview real quick, I just want to make sure everybody looks in the show notes today. There's going to be a link to Dr. Park's Telegram, a link to this amazing documentary, and also a link to an article that Wendy did for us for Uncover DC that really is amazing journalism, Frank. It ties the bow on this whole Fauci thing with Project Veritas in ways that it'll blow your mind. I was like, holy moly, Wendy. Wow. Like she pulled things together that nobody has pulled together so far. So I'll make sure you guys read that. It's in the show notes.
Fantastic.
Without further ado, we're running late today. So thank you for your time, Frank. And we are off to the races with the brilliant Dr. Christina Parks. She got her PhD in cellular and molecular biology from the University of Michigan in 1999 and did her graduate research in the field of cytokine signaling. Cytokines are those chemicals that the immune system uses to communicate, which brings a wealth of knowledge for her about how both COVID and COVID vaccines could affect the immune system. Where I first saw her was a couple of months ago, maybe, I don't know, 5-6 months ago, when she testified in front of the Michigan House on Bill 4471, which was seeking to ban discrimination based on vaccine mandates. And she gave a fantastic 8-minute talk about how vaccines in general have been sort of misappropriated, for lack of a better word. Dr. Parks, so glad to have you with us today.
Yes.
I'm honored to be here, Tracy.
So fantastic. So we bumped into each other in the little COVID group that Kenakoa the Great founded on Telegram.
Yeah, that was such an honor for him to invite me in. And you guys have been so super helpful because I'm a scientist, not a social media influencer. So I'm like, help, I'm drowning in spam.
That's all changing, though, because a lot of people love that. What I love about your channel is that it's all evidence-based. There is no conjecture. You're sharing study, you're sharing lectures that you've given, you're sharing lectures of others. And I love that. So I want to just dive right into it because you're not necessarily just awakening like some people are to the kind of vaccine issue. Can you tell us a little bit about your history and how you kind of came to scratch your head a little bit about the vaccine program in general?
Right. You know, the press always wants to make everyone an anti-vaxxer, you know, a pejorative or whatever. And many people, they get into this because they have vaccine injured children. But in truth, I'm really just straightforward. I'm just a scientist. I don't have vaccine injured children. It's all based on the science. And it started, you know, 30 years ago when I was in graduate school in the early 90s, I was like, seeing things with the vaccine schedule that didn't make sense. Like, why are they adding a vaccine for chickenpox? It's a mild illness that gives lifelong immunity. And then they started moving the vaccines under 2 years of age. And that was a huge red flag because we knew that the immune system isn't even developed enough to mount a proper immune response to give good immunity at that time. And so I didn't really understand what was going on. And in fact, even 15 years ago or more, I was teaching in the public schools and I told them at that time, I said, this is going to be the issue of our day. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was gonna
yeah. And I mean, look, you in your testimony in front of the House in Michigan, you brought up pertussis, which is near and dear to me for a personal reason. So to hear you talk about that, my husband and I, when it happened, we're looking at each other like, ah. So can you explain what's happening with the pertussis vaccine before we get into everything else?
Sure. So the old pertussis vaccine, DTP, which I was probably given as a child, which is probably why I have problems, right?
Yeah.
Was extremely reactogenic. It caused seizures. It caused a huge immune response because it had parts of bacterial cell membrane in it that are just extremely inflammatory and reactive in the body. So they knew this, although they didn't say it. So they moved that overseas. So our black and brown brothers and sisters overseas, lovely, and created a safer vaccine called DTaP that has an acellular version of the pertussis vaccine. And what it is they basically took out all of that cell membrane and bacteria, basically ground up bacteria. And what they did is they just used the pertussis toxin. And the pertussis toxin is what actually gives you the symptoms of pertussis. It makes you cough. And so it teaches your body to neutralize the toxin, which is great because then you don't have this life-threatening symptoms in children who are 6 months and younger. However, what it does not do is neutralize the bacteria. So pertussis is actually whooping cough is caused by a bacteria, and it doesn't prevent you from getting the bacteria. So what happens, and it really, the vaccine is only most, unless it's a live viral vaccine, which this is not, they only give a few months to a few years of immunity at all, and then they wear off. And so children, they get it, and maybe when they get pertussis, they don't get severely ill. But what happens is when they're two or three or four, they go to daycare, and they actually pick up the bacteria, again or for the first time. But they don't have any symptoms. And so it wouldn't be a problem if they weren't coming home to a possible newborn, because usually people have children in groups, like, you know, one after another, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you've got a toddler, it's not unlikely that you're going to have a newborn at home. And that newborn is not vaccinated against pertussis until 2 months. And quite honestly, I'm not even sure that that's going to take it 2 months. It's really early for the immune system to try to respond. So that infant is unlikely to be protected against pertussis. And these toddlers are bringing it home for daycare. They don't have any symptoms because, again, they were vaccinated and it teaches it to neutralize the toxin. But this infant has almost no protection, and so they can get quite ill. And then what they've done in the media is spin it and say, yes, pertussis is on the rise, which you would expect because it doesn't prevent transmission. And then they say it's because of the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah.
And then they have the nerve to have that terrible commercial where grandma's not vaccinated, and she's the big bad wolf bringing pertussis. It's not grandma. If grandma got to 70 without seeing whooping cough, we are living in a fantasy world. Grandma has had whooping cough. Trust me. All right. Recovered, has lifelong immunity. So grandma does not need a vaccine against whooping cough. It's that those children, those toddlers that are bringing it home from daycare or from their play groups or from wherever.
So asymptomatic, in quotes, sort of spread is causing the increase in pertussis, but they're blaming it on people who haven't gotten vaccines because why not? The vaccine lobby is so large, basically.
Exactly. They have the bacteria, but they're asymptomatic.
Interesting. So that, you know, there's that. Frank, you got a question?
Well, I mean, we might be going into, maybe this could be saved for the end, but the first thing that pops up in my mind, because I've been having a lot of these conversations recently, doctor, because I just had my first child back in September of 2020. And in the lead up to that, this was the big question. How are we going to go about not only the timing, the spacing, or taking part in this schedule of injections at all, but how are we also going to do this under the political climate that we live in New York? So, but other than that, my biggest question that I asked everybody was, are there any vaccines on the schedule for childhood that are actually useful, that have shown to be safe and effective in doing what they pretend to do? So I'm wondering about that. Are there any that you have seen that actually do what they do and there's little to worry about as far as adverse reaction?
Well, I that sort of backs me into a corner, and it's actually a really complex question because I kept thinking, well, this vaccine would be okay. And then researching it and being like, yeah. So there's some that are obviously not either necessary or not safe. Hepatitis B is very reactogenic. And, you know, we're wondering why we're vaccinating for a sexually transmitted disease on the first day of birth with 250 micrograms of aluminum in it. So there's some that we can be like, I really don't think my child needs that. But there's others. So and that's why I'm for informed consent. And that's why I really like to teach. So there are still, most parents are still going to want to get the DTaP, the pertussis vaccine. But it begs the question. So this is where pharma has just rammed stuff down our throat. Why do we have a diphtheria component and a tetanus component when children under 5 do not ever get tetanus in this vaccine, which adds like 500 micrograms of aluminum to it? And it is that much more reactive. Why aren't we just vaccinating for pertussis? So, you know, I think that many parents are still going to want to get that vaccine, but that's their informed consent.
Right? Well, if I can just interject, because like I said, this is very fresh for me. What we were told about tetanus in particular was that if we go outside to teach our baby, you know, the ins and outs of just gardening or just letting her play in the dirt, you can get tetanus from the dirt. That's what we were told.
Well, it's a theoretical possibility. Your child could also get hit by an asteroid. But the statistics show that essentially no infants under the age of 5 get tetanus. It's here in the first world. Now, if you're cutting the umbilical cord with a rusty screwdriver in a third world country, and that's actually that scenario, cutting it with a rusty razor blade is where they did see them get tetanus. You know, our immune systems actually work quite well. And tetanus, even in the First World War, was exceedingly rare. So a lot of this is pharma marketing, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's that's something else. And, you know, what I love about you is that you take the sort of approach that I'd want anybody in your field to take, which is the natural approach. How does our body work and why? And so I wanted to talk with you quickly, or maybe not quickly, depending. On the microbiome, you've shared some lectures and some information about your gut health in terms of COVID-19 and so many other things. Can you explain to us how cytokines play into that, what leaky gut does to the body, and how this is something that people can fix? Or, you know, just talk about that for a few minutes.
Right. So, and I have to credit Building Bridges and Children's Health with Tatiana Baganich. It's a group that I've been in that's really looking at mechanism. And I'll let her tell her own story, but she has a very interesting story about recovering her own health that incidentally may be related to COVID. just wild to me. But because we've been in this group for like 3 years now.
Wow.
So that's a backstory there that I have to let her share. But I'm really into gut health. She has gone down. This is some of this information is her baby, which is why I want to give her credit. But we know that people are developing leaky gut at an alarming rate. And it is definitely predisposing to both vaccine injury and COVID. And so the question is exactly how and how can we fix it? Because why is the gut leaky? So what leaky gut means is your cells are supposed to be like sort of cemented together, but instead there's room between them and stuff is leaking between your cells into your bloodstream. So when that happens, your body has an immune response to it, like it's basically a foreign particle. And then you're going to react to that whenever you eat it and it leaks through your gut. And so it doesn't matter. Like people are like, I have all these food allergies. And so you stop eating that, you eat another food, that's going to leak through. You're going to have the same problem with that until you deal with a leaky gut. So why are they having leaky gut? There's a few big reasons. A huge one is glyphosate. So hopefully your audience knows a little bit about glyphosate, which is Roundup.
Monsanto. And
what I did not know until my nephew got pandas, which is an autoimmune disorder in response to strep bacteria, is that glyphosate or Roundup is sprayed on all seed crops prior to harvest in some areas in the U.S. So here in Michigan, you get into the fall and things get kind of wonky with the weather. And what the farmer can do is they can spray their oat crop with glyphosate. It will kill it. It will actually seed out even better than it would normally. It will do it uniformly on schedule, and then they can harvest it. But they just sprayed a ton of Roundup on it, and then they're going to harvest it and give it to you. It's not even going to get rained on. And so they're spraying it on all seed crops, beans, legumes. All of you who are eating hummus, there are astronomical residues of Roundup on chickpeas.
Wow.
So you absolutely have to have an organic. And my sister had been eating a ton of hummus during her pregnancy, thinking she was being healthy, right?
Yeah.
So what glyphosate does is it's a patented antibiotic. It destroys your gut bacteria and all of the things that they make that signal your body. For instance, we know that when you have a respiratory infection like a virus, your gut actually signals your immune system in your lungs, and you're much more likely to end up in ICU if you get antibiotics with that infection. So you need your gut bacteria to actually mount an effective immune response.
So then, doctor, this makes me think about something I've done a lot of work on my own show with a few guests that I brought on. I did two particular segments on the difference between germ theory and terrain theory, and what you're describing here seems like it's right in that arena right there, where the terrain, the gut biome, keeping all of this in order, that would actually be something where the body is balanced enough where germs are just a natural part of life and the environment you'll be able to deal with it no matter what. Whereas it seems like the mainstream way of dealing with everything is to identify the one germ, the one virus that needs to be targeted with a specific drug and to keep us safe, instead of trying to actually find out and strengthen the way the body naturally works. So do you work within that arena?
Yeah, absolutely. Because my field is cellular signaling. And so every dysfunction and disease is basically a breakdown in signaling. Your body is not getting the right signal. When you kill all your gut bacteria, when you reduce the diversity that's in your gut, you've reduced the information that your body is getting. In fact, now we know even, parasites, they signal, and your body is actually designed to stay in balance unless it's not getting a critical need, like a critical nutrient, or we're constantly killing it. So to take it a step further, that Roundup kills a lot of the good bacteria, and it selects for E. coli strains that are extremely inflammatory to the body. So let's say you did have leaky gut. If you had a very excellent microflora, they're actually not that inflammatory. If they kind of, some of them broke down and leaked through your gut, they're not that inflammatory. But these E. coli that this Roundup, which is ubiquitous in our diet, is selecting for, is extremely inflammatory. So when it leaks through, it creates a huge inflammatory response. It's actually acting a little bit like an adjuvant. So it's going to make you allergic to any food particles that leak through with it, right? And so actually the spike protein, so the coronavirus actually infects the gut and it has receptors there. And the spike protein actually makes you have leaky gut. So if you already had leaky gut, you're twice, you know, in bad shape. And the spike protein, especially in children, actually leaks through the gut into the bloodstream and causes widespread inflammation, goes to the different organs and causes this multi-system inflammatory disorder.
Ah, so
when they give a drug that closes that gut barrier, all those symptoms go away.
So how does one fix their microbiome? What kind of probiotic, I'm assuming, and also organic eating and just, you know, how do you know, like, what symptoms would you have if does everybody have this and not know? I guess I'm trying to figure out what your signal would be if you're one of those people.
So if you ever eat something and then you feel weird, sometimes you can almost feel like a rush or a flush. If you have a large histamine response when you eat things, that could be an indicator. If you have food allergies, for sure, for sure.
Amazing.
If they're not really allergies, I would say almost everybody probably has some aspect of this. And so, some of us have genetic predispositions that make it harder for our body to overcome this. Some of us, you see, and there's a threshold, which beyond you're going to see disease, but you want to stop it before that threshold where you're still in the normal range, you know, because who wants to not be able to eat bread or what all, you know, all these things that people do, because once leaky gut is a problem, you really have all kind of food issues. So what I would say is that the first thing is, you've got to eat organic, especially for those seed crops, for those grains. And, you know, that's really not that hard in this day and age, you know, to go to Meijer, to do whatever. And so you need not to be getting Roundup. And then secondarily, it's a little bit more complex. We actually have something called a postbiotic. So the problem with just a probiotic is sometimes those bacteria aren't ready to stay and you've got to feed them. So you've got to have a probiotic, which has the bacteria. You've got to have a prebiotic, which feeds the bacteria, or eat things like apples and beets, which have really good forms of fiber that feed the bacteria and have those bacteria make the correct signaling molecules. So the reason those bacteria are so important is because they're actually signaling your whole system. And they make things like butyrate, which is in butter. Like we were taught butter was terrible, right? So go get yourself some goat milk because it's got, like, you know, non-pasteurized goat milk. It's got, and I'm not giving medical advice, by the way.
We know that.
Yeah, it's got these, all of these signaling molecules already in it to help restore your gut function. But it's also got all the bacteria that you need. And it's got, and, you know, assuming it's coming from a good source. And it's got the things that would feed them as well. And so, like, those non-pasteurized milk sources, you know, things like that are optimal because it has everything. If you're trying to supplement, then you've got to have a probiotic, a prebiotic, and a postbiotic. A postbiotic, actually, what it is it's a fermented product that has all that stuff that was made, and you're putting it back into your gut to restore the signaling, because that signaling tells your gut what to absorb, what not to absorb, restore gut function. And so that is the sort of the new cutting edge, is that postbiotic to restore signaling while you're trying to get everything back in shape.
And you know, what's crazy is that all those things you mentioned, especially in the milk, you remember the raw milk wars back in like the early 2000s, right? There were the war against raw, and everybody was getting sick from raw milk. No, quite the opposite.
You know, I'm glad she brought up goat milk too, because of the nutritionists and doctors I were talking to on the side when right after the baby was born, because we were wondering, you know, what if we have to supplement at all with any kind of formula, what should we use? And they all said the closest thing, the most nutritious thing that you can get to human breast milk is goat milk.
Absolutely. So, and yeah. I went down that same track because my daughter had a brain abscess in Ethiopia. She had brain surgery there. And I went in and there was diarrhea everywhere. I said, what happened? They're like, well, we're giving her the American formula. We know it's what you wanted. They were trying to clean it up and like keep it from you. I'm like, not if it causes this, you know? Mm-hmm. So they have a whey-based formula over in Ethiopia. So I was like, what do I do? And she couldn't tolerate the cow's milk formulas. So I ended up putting her on raw goat's milk for about a year and a half, two years, thanks to friends and neighbors. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made. But because of her abscess, she had been on antibiotics for more than 6 months and some anti-protists and all kinds of, you know, harmful things. And so I think that was probably one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. And of course, my pediatrician was like, she's going to die, you know.
So these signaling mechanisms that are messed up when you've got leaky gut are what cause COVID to be worse in terms of the inflammation that really is the killer with this virus?
Right. And so I would say in general, if you have leaky gut, so, you know, a lot of people come to me. I have a supplement company. If you go to my Telegram page, I can, you know, put more information there. But a lot of people come to me about these issues. And the people who have the most trouble healing from anything and recovering from COVID are those that have leaky gut. And the reason is every time something leaks into your gut, it signals like an inflammatory response in your whole body. So you just can't seem to get over it. You start, the inflammation dies down, you eat again, right? You eat three times a day.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly, and so you already are so far in the threshold of inflammation that when you add COVID to that, it's just, it pushes you well beyond the threshold. So the way cytokines work, they activate a gene called NF-kappa-B, which is your master inflammatory response. And once it's activated, it goes and activates more inflammatory cytokines, which go back and activate the gene, which activate more inflammatory cytokines. So it's really not hard for the system to have a pro-inflammatory loop that just keeps feeding on itself and goes septic. And so that's why someone can quickly go septic once that system is off and running. COVID itself actually disrupts key mitochondrial functions that help the immune system shut down inflammation. Vitamin D shuts down inflammation. So if you're deficient in vitamin D, COVID's already destroying your ability to shut down inflammation. So it's just much more likely that that pro-inflammatory loop is going to spiral out of control and you're going to go septic.
That it's crazy to me. So you went in your studies, since this is a specialty of yours, how much attention did you end up being naturally drawn to autoimmune issues because this is kind of your focus?
Well, I have been for several years, like a few years back, I was already very skeptical of the vaccines. And in fact, when we had our children, I got Dr. Sears's book and I read it like laughing with tears in my eyes as he told me all these horrible things about the vaccines and said, and I still recommend this. I was like, well, I'm not doing that one. But then I came across Suzanne Humphreys, and she is a medical doctor who started seeing kidney problems with people who were being vaccinated, like for flu and whatnot. And she had quite a bit of information she was putting out. And so from there, I ended up finding PubMed was online. And so as I found more and more information, I wanted to know. See, I always thought there was mechanism for vaccine injury. Back in the 90s, when the CDC said, we see there are no data that show that vaccines cause autism. I'm like, because you're not looking, right? Scientists are very careful to listen to what you say, you know? And so I said, they're playing with words to make it sound like this isn't happening, but it's a wordplay. It's all semantics. And so, Andrew Wakefield came out, I believed it because there were other people doing similar things in the field. What he was saying was entirely plausible. So I saw this cover up from the beginning. And if you had told me we would be here, you know, 20, 30 years later, I would have been blown away that this could have been taken this far. So I always saw mechanism, and I saw these vaccine injured children. Like if you are familiar with McDowell triplets, this couple had triplets that all regressed into autism within 24 hours after a contaminated pneumococcal vaccine. Mm. And the amount of suffering and pain that these families are going through is so astronomical that God just put a burden on my heart to find out the mechanism of injury so that we can heal it. We've got to know what's going wrong before we can right it. And so it's just kind of a God thing that my background was in cytokine signaling. So I sort of was very familiar with these pathways and very able to read the literature and follow up on it.
So it's interesting to me because it's been this progression, right? So we had this happening with certain inoculations in kids for a very, very long time. And then they made it into some woo-woo spiritual hippie kind of anti-vax movement thing. Then Gardasil came out, doctor, and that made the working group of injured bigger. And now I feel like with the COVID vaccine, we're now at this sort of place of critical mass with injury, and there's too many people for them to say it's not happening. So What are some of the study that you've been doing on the different things that this vaccine is causing? Because it's cancer, because of the toll-like receptors being kind of messed with. It's obviously neurological injury. It's thrombocytopenia. It's death. It's all kinds of things. What are you finding? And are you seeing qualitative numbers of this?
I'm just reading the literature. Since I'm not in the lab, I'm not a lab scientist at this point, but there's so much science. I do not have time to take a breath. So there's plenty of scientists who are out there that are skeptical. And I am connected with a group called React 19 of vaccine injured. And because this is such a passion, we're going to do the Stop the Mandates in D.C. That group is putting that on. And there we're going to start an initiative to draw scientists and doctors together to look at this vaccine injury. They have actually a huge pool of data about which injuries are most likely, what the cause is, what possible diagnostics were, and what treatments might be. That really, it's a beginning point, right?
Yeah.
Just kind of done by lay people. But we really need to dive into those data because there's different mechanisms. There's autoimmunity that's being caused. There's the spike protein toxicity itself. There's the histamine response, mast cell activation. So some of these mechanisms are seen with other vaccine injuries and some are specific. The spike protein toxicity is very specific to this, and the downregulation of our body's own immune surveillance when they knew that if they gave this, it would cause an anaphylactic reaction. So they tweaked these nanolipid particles to actually downregulate our own immune response. But it doesn't stop after you get the vaccine. It continues to be downregulated. So your body is not as likely to see cancer, not as likely to respond appropriately to a viral infection. And so things may get out of hand before your body can handle it. And if you have comorbidities, that's going to put you in a really bad place. So that spike protein, and again, this is made inside your cells. You are giving all these cells the instruction to make this toxic spike protein, which then binds to tumor suppressors and may inactivate them, which then binds to the mitochondria and does mitochondrial damage. So you can't make the energy you need and you can't downregulate inflammation. So it's doing so many toxic things. Then it actually gets out of the cell, travels through your bloodstream and goes other places. And now it looks like that these aberrant spike proteins are being packaged and sent to the brain to cause what is essentially about the same thing as mad cow disease.
This blows my mind. And you just said something and I could be completely wrong. And you'll just tell me if that's the case. I'm just curious about this. You did a lecture or a talk where you talked about how there's an HIV protein inside of the COVID virus, which everybody kind of blew up about when they first found it way back in the day. And then you just basically said that the vaccine itself or the shot itself is causing that same sort of reaction of the immune system just because it's reacting to the lipid nanoparticle it needed to get into the cell in the first place. Is that correct so far?
It has an HIV motif. It has a short sequence of amino acids that is similar to the GP120 protein in the HIV virus. And so, that looks like something that they put in. Because remember, coronaviruses aren't really inflammatory. And so this could be not just the vaccine we're talking about. We're talking about, so this is in the spike protein, which is both in the virus and what the vaccine tells your body to make. So in the virus, when you get COVID, coronaviruses aren't inflammatory. So it makes you wonder if it was engineered with this inflammatory region that's actually very neurotoxic of the one of the HIV proteins to make it more inflammatory.
So I see a correlation here. This was known and they still developed the mRNA to instruct your cell to make that exact spike protein still containing those amino acids. Is that what?
Yes. As if they're all morons.
Yeah.
Right?
That's where I'm going with this.
I testified in several, as you can see, I'm just your typical homeschool mom that has no clue. Right. I've testified in several custody cases and, the last one, the judge said that my opinion was no more expert than a layperson.
Oh, okay.
After 12 years of school. Yeah, it was extremely disrespectful. I kind of lost my train of thought, but my point being that, yeah, there's if okay, so they kind of trying to denigrate me because I've been out of science to raise my children, to homeschool them, because a lot of us saw this train coming in terms of our civil liberties and things like that. And so they try to denigrate me and marginalize me and say that, you know, I'm not really qualified to have an opinion here. But if I know this, why don't our top scientists know this?
Well, I mean, there's only so many people that they can cast aside and say are crazy before they're looking only at themselves, right? I mean, they've kind of gone through the list at this point of experts. Any expert that steps forward, yourself, any of them, they're turned into crazy lunatics. And we do know now, and we've known for a little while, that they did engineer this virus. What just came out yesterday, whether or not this is the absolute truth or not, is that they were actually engineering COVID-19 to be able to inoculate bats. So it sort of was like a almost like a live aerosolized attenuated vaccine for the bats in the caves so that they wouldn't then spread COVID. Can you speak to that at all? Does it make sense?
I hear you, and I heard Robert Malone speak on it. I just say, yeah, right.
It made me feel a little better about humanity, but at the same time,
I don't know. I believe that that's probably their story. Somebody was making a weapon.
Yeah.
Somebody was making a weapon, whether there was a group, there may be scientists that thought that that's what they were doing while they were essentially helping to make a weapon. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like everyone might not have been in the know, and that was their story. Just like the Iranians were just, you know, want a nuclear power to, you know, fund their oil rich country.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
I mean, yeah,
story. We need a story for the story. I want to get into something a little controversial, and you helped me quite a bit when you explained this. And I don't know how far we're going to be able to go with it, but we are getting all of a sudden over the past like 5 weeks or so, a flood of people who are saying they've never, ever once isolated the COVID-19 virus in and of itself. And they have never been able to kind of take it on its own in a laboratory and, you know, isolate it from wherever. Now, I'm not a scientist. And so it's very hard for me to learn all of this, to refute this or be a proponent of it. I just know it goes against everything I've ever known about COVID-19. Can you help explain this at all for anyone?
I can try to help. It's a really complicated discussion to have. So I really haven't had it. I've just sort of ignored those people. Mm-hmm. but you know, since we're talking, we will have that conversation. So it has to do with how technology works nowadays. And so how they used to isolate a virus is you would, you know, swab someone's throat or whatever, you would get it and then you would grow it on human cells, right? And when you had enough virus, you would actually sort of spin it down and you would purify it and, you know, and sequence it or whatever. You would, you know, sequence the proteins, you would, you know, isolate out the genetic material and sequence that. So, and so you would sort of characterize it using bulk amounts of the virus. That is extremely time intensive and it's extremely dangerous because you have to have like a level 4, you know, security to do all of that because you're working with such high amounts of virus. So now what they do is they do something called gene walking. So what they do, let's say you wanted to be able to, let's say you have a book and you want to know what the book says. And so you can't read it, but what you can do is you can put in a short sequence, like maybe something that says, you know, that the first line of the book says, she was walking down the street. So you're like, okay, let's put in, it's called a primer that says she was walking down the street. And what that primer will do, and then you put in another primer that maybe goes a couple, we know that later on in the book, someone says, hey, can I get you a glass of milk? So we're going to put that primer in. And what those will do is they will copy everything in between those two sentences.
Ah.
All right. So, but in general, that's not the whole book. Maybe that was only 5 pages. So what they do is they put those primers in and copy everything that's there. And then they say, okay, well, now we need the next section. So then they start with the second sentence that I said, add a third sentence, and then capture everything between those two sentences. So it's called gene walking. But can you imagine, what if there are other books in there with similar sentences, right?
Yeah.
So how do you know that you're actually getting it from that book and that there's no corruption of what you're copying?
And is there a way? Question,
yeah, you can grow it up and sequence it.
Ah, so the original way is the way.
Yeah, to sort of verify. But secondarily, there's this issue that people have said, and I honestly haven't had the time to go into the nitty-gritty of the methods, but from what I have seen, and Judy Mikovits has made some comments about this, they're growing them up in vero cells, which are a monkey kidney cell. So the question is, why aren't they able to grow them up in human cells? And the thing is, vero cells don't have any antiviral defenses. They don't have any interferon signaling. And that's why they're actually used to grow up like live virus, live viral vaccines, like measles or mumps or rubella or something. So they don't have any antiviral defenses. And so if something doesn't have any antiviral defenses, guess what there's a lot of in them? There's a lot of viruses.
Other ones.
So, other ones, any kind of viruses. So remember with the polio vaccine, when they gave the polio vaccine to hamsters, they developed these enormous tumors. And they were growing those in monkey kidney cells as well, and with no antiviral defenses. And so they said, oh, there's some sort of virus in here that that's causing cancer. And they said, but we'll give the vaccine to everybody anyway, while we look and see and find this this virus that causes cancer. The virus was SV40, simian virus 40, which I studied in graduate school as the prototypical cancer-causing virus. But of course, at that time, I had no idea it had been in the polio vaccine. But that was the 40th virus that they, monkey virus, that they pulled out of the cell line and to find out, and that was the one that causes cancer. So they pulled out 40 monkey viruses out of these cells. So how many viruses are in there? And are they recombining? Like, it's a Disneyland of virus. Who knows what you're pulling out? It's just not really great science. But it doesn't mean that the virus that they're pulling out isn't the one that's infecting people. It's just not really clean science.
So has nobody done the building original expensive dangerous method?
Not that I know of, but I have not seen that specific paper because it's just so time intensive. But you know, this is a global thing. So I'm not going to say no one's done it anywhere. Clearly there is a virus. Clearly they're sequencing parts of it. And you know, we've got the spike protein and things like this. But to say that this is exactly this virus is, it's just a little bit of, to me, it's sloppy science. I wouldn't go so far as to say they haven't isolated the virus. But it does beg a lot of questions of like, why aren't they growing this in human cells? And so I, again, would need to go back and look at those data very specifically. But I think somebody should. I just haven't had the time because to me, it's like one of the least important issues here.
Yeah. Yeah, no, understood. I think the argument is how can you, you know, close down society if you haven't even been able to isolate this as its own thing? And there are a myriad of reasons why I push back against that that theory, because it is very unimportant right now in the grand scheme of things, honestly. I mean, we've seen enough people sick with something, whether that you call it COVID-19 or part of COVID-19. But if you remember, in the very beginning of all of this, Chinese scientists leaked the genome of this virus online, and a blogger, a scientific blogger here in the United States, had grabbed that information and had it up on his website, and then it was yanked down maybe 3 weeks later. So I physically looked at this myself. It was very complicated. I had no idea what I was looking at. I'm like, wow, this is way over my head, obviously, but it was done. So what you've just told me, it kind of is going to feed both sides at this point, which is fine.
Well, to me, the bigger issue is like the idea that no one said this is biological warfare when this happened was like moronically brain dead to me. Right. We have all these thriller novels about biological warfare, but everyone's like, oh, couldn't be. And the thing is, all the published science, the science of them creating these chimeric viruses was already there. So we already know they're working on it. You know, so
yeah.
It's just like, you know, brain dead. And so, you know, why are we allowing these gain of function studies? Why aren't we dealing with this? Like, I thought, you know, this is biological warfare. The U.S. is going to step up. And then when the whole hydroxychloroquine piece came out, I was physically ill because I realized our government is part of it. It's not going to defend us. They're destroying hydroxychloroquine so that they can destroy us for whatever deep state reason. And I knew a lot of people were going to die because that's what they wanted.
And so it was hydroxychloroquine, obviously still ivermectin. If you listened to Anthony Fauci yesterday, you probably were pounding the screen. I couldn't believe when he said there were no good double-blind study on ivermectin done. I almost lost it. But these are life-saving medicines that we know work. We know they work. Do you have any insight that's different than what we may have heard about how they work, though?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, I was following this in January, and there was stuff coming out of China that they were using hydroxychloroquine. So I looked it up then, and I was blown away. I know, and it was an anti-malarial, but, you know, DDA Rode has been working on this for decades, and he showed that it prevented viral replication, but he had already shown, they've shown the mechanism by which it's broadly antiviral. You know, it acidifies the lysosomes, the pH of these little intracellular compartments where the virus is replicated. And so the virus can't replicate. You know, it also seems to prevent some of the viral binding to the cells. So hydroxychloroquine works by maybe four or five different mechanisms. Hydroxychloroquine also shuts down inflammation. That's why it's used for things like rheumatoid arthritis. And it also helps with diabetes and hypertension. It helps with metabolic syndrome by shutting down some of that inflammatory signaling through the JAK-STAT junk pathway. And so there's through a molecule called AKT, which means nothing to you. But all of this literature is right out there. And in fact, it's being used as a therapeutic in third world countries for things like diabetes, hypertension, for especially people of African descent who that can be a problem for because it's so cheap. And so even if you weren't going to use it to stop COVID, it actually reduces your comorbidities, your predisposing factors by reducing inflammation. So, this is an amazing, amazing medication. And then I saw that since we're getting little blurbs that Marburg or some Ebola-like hemorrhagic fever is coming out of China, that if you inject hydroxychloroquine intraperitoneally into the body cavity, they showed that it cured monkeys from Ebola.
So again, super amazing medicine. The whole thing going on over in China is bothering me to no end because I think that there's a lot of kind of hyperbolic fear mongering going on about that outbreak of hemorrhagic fever, only because it's endemic in that part of the world and very common during this season specifically. And it's coupled with an outbreak of Omicron there. So they're over exaggerating their Omicron response. So everybody's kind of blowing it out of proportion. I personally have seen literally zero information to kind of go with the hypothesis that this is mutated out of leaky vaccine for COVID. That is just a jump.
Well, that's unlikely. But, you know, the thing is the public believes whatever they tell them. So like people have been saying, oh, smallpox. And I said, I haven't really seen any credible data that they're going to use smallpox. I've seen a lot on Marburg, which is, again, a hemorrhagic fever. Mm-hmm. So if they're going to release something, it's going to be Marburg. But, you know, then you ask, would they really do that? Like, would they really release something that they have? So that's a lot. It's going to be a lot harder to deal with than coronavirus.
Not only but it kills 80% of the people it infects. It wouldn't last very long, would it?
Right. Well, it may attenuate or whatever. Right. I mean, that's true. And some of them, you know, and is it going to be spread like the flu? Like most hemorrhagic fevers, you need body fluids to spread. Mm-hmm. But their goal is of course, fear. You know, I just came across a friend in the grocery store. She still had a mask on. She didn't want to. She's like, I learned about your supplements, but I'm afraid to take them. But, you know, she had taken the vaccine. And it's so heartbreaking to see people paralyzed by fear. And this is just one more way for them to continue that paralysis of fear, where those of us who are warriors are like, I'm going to die sometime.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, Frank and I say it all the time, like, all right, whatever. We're just done with it. And the problem is the boy that cried wolf. And then God forbid anything ever does happen. Nobody's going to believe anything they say. They've completely destroyed all credibility. And
the worst part is that I never made light of people being sick or people dying or anything like that. But they've taken such an unfortunate reality of our day-to-day lives over the course of our normal lives prior to 2020, and they've weaponized it in such a way that now it's like, well, anytime somebody dies, whether they are celebrity status or just local, everybody wants to know if it was COVID. Everybody wants to know what their vaccination status was, and then you become a cautionary tale for one political faction over the other, and you're not even alive at that point to defend yourself. It's become so horrible, such a horrible thing.
Many of us have relatives that have suffered or died from COVID, or friends, and we can't even save our relatives, not because we don't have the knowledge, but because of lack of access to medications, or because our loved one isn't quite ready. They start taking ivermectin and they stop, or they're not prepared, even though we've told them every day for 2 years to get something, you know, and or they're like, I don't think I can take horse paste, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we have reduced our population to taking horse paste. Like, hello.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's crazy. Like I just said the other day, well, I mean, I guess I'm going to be neighing now for the rest of my life because I'm on a prophylaxis dose of ivermectin all the time. And one of the arguments I heard from somebody that I'm very close with and is very, very brilliant is we have a very long-term safety data in daily hydroxychloroquine use, right? But we really don't have that data for ivermectin. What do you think about that?
There's some data that suggests that ivermectin can be somewhat cytotoxic. So I'm not a purist. It's a very safe medication. And most of us are like, yeah, like, you know, we're not sure we're going to make it out of this, you know, the government comes against us anyway. So we're not, you know, concerned. But what I would say that if you are going to be on it long term, there are ways that you probably need some antioxidant support. You need to make sure your glutathione, and that's something I can text you personally about, or I'll post some things on it on my page. Like I said, I sell a supplement that I'm on that provides that antioxidant support that when in combined with ivermectin makes me less worried. So I would be a little bit more concerned. And I've talked to people who have like special needs children or people who are prophylactic. And I said, you know, especially if the person themselves are nervous, that hydroxychloroquine has a much, and then you're taking much less because hydroxychloroquine has a very long half-life. It stays in the body for, you know, months. So, you know, half-life of 29 days. So that would be my preferred method. But, you know, we also have to look at the data and say, is that still protecting against, you know, these variants? Because I know Delta was so severe and, you know, people needed to be on hydroxychloroquine. I mean, they needed to be doing everything they could.
Yeah, both.
And so... Yeah. And so I'm, you know, a little bit leery that is hydroxychloroquine going to be enough of a prophylactic? I don't know. Ivermectin is definitely more effective at this point, especially against Delta. And it's effective at all stages of the disease. So don't let someone tell you, you know, oh, you're too far gone to take ivermectin. Hydroxychloroquine is going to be better as a prophylactic and right on that front end. And as an anti-inflammatory is why you would continue taking it with the ivermectin to keep that inflammation down. So I'm more comfortable with that. I'm not a medical doctor. So, you know, and I don't know that they know a lot more than I do, but, you know, at least they won't get sued, right?
Yeah, no, we get it. We'll put a little disclaimer in the show notes too, so that everybody understands you're not giving medical advice today. And it's just your opinion. And you know, the only, I guess I had another question about HCQ from earlier. You know, I have a lot of this stuff kind of going on, so I've learned a lot from you today about, you know, how the body works, particularly with leaky gut or whatever. Where can people find your supplements, though? Because now I'm going to race over there.
So I will go ahead. What I have is, and I have a friend of mine who's a distributor under me that's doing all of this because I'm like, I can't track. I'm doing too much. And I do give talks. So I'll post something on my Telegram page. And what it is, I have another page that's specifically for that. And for those who are familiar, the company is called Life Vantage. The product is called Protandem. And I do give, because I understand, it activates the body's own antioxidant system is what you're doing. So this is nutrigenomics, using herbs and basically herbs and maybe some other supplements to basically activate your genes to turn on your body's antioxidant response, turn on your detox response. And I'll have a link to that. And if, you know, I'll say, if you're interested, put your name here and we'll add you to, and I'll make sure you get added, Tracy.
Yeah. please.
We'll add you to that group because it's fascinating science. I think it's a paradigm shift in the way, it's probably the biggest medical breakthrough in a couple hundred years, honestly.
Wow.
And I was like, when I was looking at mechanism, as soon as someone showed it to me, I said, I know exactly what this is trying to do because I knew all the genetics of it, all the signaling.
That's amazing. I love it. I love that it's evidence-based. That's just so huge for me. I need to see it. I need to see it for my own.
There's 30 peer-reviewed papers. And, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, I know exactly what it's trying to do, but it's going to be some terrible pharmaceutical, but no, it's a mixture of five herbs. And so the company is Nutrigenomic Company, amazing company. And, you know, I'm just privileged I think it's a God thing again for this time.
Yeah.
You know, for this time.
The whole healthcare industry is changing. And I mean, we could talk about that for another hour, but I remembered my question and it's more of like, I want to get your opinion because you've been one of the few people to honestly discuss the difference in how COVID-19 affects people of different racial background. And one of the things that I kind of back away from often, as I see a lot of people are kind of getting angry that they're, quote, rationing monoclonal antibodies for people of color right now, but they are biologically at greater risk for COVID. Can you explain that a little bit?
Right. There's many different reasons for that. It's pretty complex. One is that African Americans, people of African descent that were in that the Sahara Desert belt, it's the meningitis belt or the malaria belt also, had a lot of malaria. And like when white people came in and, you know, tried to, you know, colonize or whatever, they died in droves from malaria. Africans had developed mutations that are actually protective. And what those mutations did is they compromised your ability to actually transport oxygen. When the system is stressed, your red blood cells either blow up or are destroyed by the body because they're not stable. And
are you talking about sickle cell?
Sickle cell is one of them. There's sickle cell anemia, beta thalassemia, and something that's more metabolic called glucose 6 phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency.
Okay.
All of these cause your blood cells to basically die and be removed from the body when you have an acute stressor, which of course malaria is. Since the malaria parasite lives in those cells, it's cleansed from the body. So you go through this crisis and it's like not nice or pretty, but when you recover, basically you don't have malaria anymore, right? And so if you had both, like if you got a bad mutation from mom and dad, you're really, really, really sick. But if you are heterozygote, you're fine most of the time. But when you get malaria, your system devolves, but you clear the parasite and then you make more red blood cells and you get better. However, there are certain medications and something like COVID is an acute stressor. And so we have a lot of people, like one in about 10, that actually are a carrier for the sickle cell trait. They don't have both, so they don't know they're acutely ill, or for a beta thalassemia, or for one in 10 black males, because it's sex-linked, has this glucose 6 phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency. We don't screen for those. So when you are in a critical thing, you're not going to be able to carry your oxygen. You need probably a blood transfusion. And if they don't know it, you're not getting enough oxygen and you're just going to spiral down out of control. The other thing is African Americans don't protect themselves from viruses because the sunlight in Africa kills viruses. So they're just not exposed. So they develop mutations that we have actually enzymes. People have enzymes that break down RNA viruses. Well, what are we injecting with the vaccine? It's basically a synthetic RNA virus that is going to have much more of a load in people of African descent because they can't break it down. That and Europeans develop mutations that actually downregulate their immune response to viruses so they don't go septic, so they don't get hyperimmune. African Americans don't have those mutations. Because they didn't see the viruses. So they have more of the mRNA virus, you know, the vaccine or the COVID, and they have a higher inflammatory response and they're just more inflammatory because of other elements of their genetics. And they have these mutations that compromise their ability to carry oxygen. So it is,
you know, they basically have comorbidity by sheer existence.
Right. And of course it you know, might differ from person to person, but nobody's screening for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I just wanted to make sure you spoke about that because you've done a really amazing job at explaining that everywhere. And I thought that it was important that our audience understood it. So thank you.
Right. And I will say, I know we're getting close on time, but for African-American boys, right, the Vax movie exposed that African-American boys are more likely to get autism following the MMR vaccine. Well, what we know now is, again, one in 10 boys has this glucose 6 phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, and they get a hepatitis B vaccine on the day of birth. Like, these vaccines are destroying our Black boys, and they don't even screen for these. So, and I know that with Sheila Ely, that was her son's problem, and he ended up autistic, highly autistic, after they accidentally gave him two MMR vaccines. So, you know, this is an issue of, you know, definitely of justice. And, you know, we're pushing this. And like, if you have a child, like I know someone who is doing foster care, they have to vaccinate. She has to vaccinate this beautiful African-American boy. And no one is even screening or even looking at the possibility that he has this genetic mutation that could really make a vaccine a deadly intervention for him.
It's terrible. Like Frank was saying earlier, you almost wonder, like, what would happen if, as a society as a whole, we stopped vaccinating everybody? Would we die off of some weird bacterial or you know, odd viral infection since we stopped vaccinating? Or would we be able to handle it because we'd be healthy and our immune systems would be working?
I think that what I would do to start formulating an opinion on that would be by taking what the good doctor here was talking about in the beginning. It's one thing to say, well, we're going to stop all these shots, but if we're already treating our body and our gut biome so poorly, and we have such a detachment from what is good, proper nutrition and what our bodies are capable of and how to actually manage it and to, what are we doing? I mean, it's one thing or the other. So I think we have a compounding problem here, and we just need a more complete picture of what we are. And I'm not very confident in.
That's true, but we already have those data. Dr. Paul Thomas in Oregon did some of those vaxxed, unvaxxed studies, partially vaxxed and unvaxxed, and the unvaccinated are so above and beyond completely more healthy than either the partially vaccinated or the fully vaccinated. So we're destroying our children's immune systems. Now, that doesn't mean that there might not be some limited window for, you know, some vaccine or another. But right now, they're basically being used as pincushions for pharma profits. It's just that simple.
Ay. What a great interview.
Yeah, I said, Tracy, I think I sent you at one point, there was a video. I'd love to send it to the doctor as well. Somebody who actually put together a 20-minute, really amazing video on YouTube about those studies. There was three studies in particular that they brought up that followed vaccinated individuals on a general health trajectory in life compared to those who had not received any shots whatsoever. And it was really staggering how much more healthy. Like it was astronomical.
Was that the Mawson study or the one that just came out by Paul Thomas?
I can go look it up, and uh-huh. I think that they might both be in there. But to your point, it was night and day. And yeah. And you know, for people to say that there's like an anti-vaxxer contingent down there, what I learned in reading about these studies is that if you want to track how many people in this country of over 330 million have never had one shot of anything in their life, you're talking about less than 900,000 people. So everybody, it's very hard to find an anti-vaxxer in this country, truly in the ways that I think some people are framing it. But when you look at the studies, they really do have an advantage, it seems.
Oh, I know. I don't know if you know Reza Islam, but I just want to be like, he's a brilliant young kid. He's like 30, I guess. But I just want to be like, this is what happens to our Black boys when they don't get vaccinated. He's never been vaccinated, you know?
It's I wish, because I have all kinds of autoimmune issues now in my 40s that I never had before. And I look back at the 80s and what they were doing besides putting fluoride in our bottles, right? All the vaccines, everything. And I say, okay, so why do I have family members who have lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, you know, whatever. Why am I now all of a sudden allergic to food? Here we are, right? So this was like wildly informative today. And I'm so glad that you came on, because I read your stuff religiously and I love you and you're so brilliant. Thank you for everything you're doing and for putting yourself out there and for homeschooling your kids.
Well, I want to thank you because, you know, some people like when I was on Dell Big Tree, my sister was like, oh, that interview was so good. And, you know, you're just growing as an interviewee. And I said, no, it's not me. It's the interviewer, person who interviews. So you did an amazing job. This was a fabulous interview because there's some interviews I'm like, yeah, that was not my best interviewer. But a lot of times it's the interviewer who interviews me. If they are good, then they bring it out. So I want to thank you. Well, I thought it was a fabulous interview.
Thank you. It's really just my curiosity and Frank's curiosity. Like, we're asking questions I'm sure a lot of people out there have. And just in listening to you so much, I've learned so much. And you know, I'm not the most scientific in the world, but for a little old journalist, I think I do okay. And now everybody out there is going to benefit from this. And I'm going to get tons of questions, I'm sure. So we might have to have you back on to answer them.
Yeah. Amen. And some of the more popular interviewers, like, I mean, Joe Rogan is a great interviewer, but some of the more popular ones, they don't know the questions to ask me. And so it just doesn't, you know, again, they don't have that curiosity. They don't have that knowledge base to really bring out everything I have to offer.
Dr. Parks, why are you an anti-vaxxer? Dr. Parks, why are you spreading misinformation on the internet about COVID-19? Are those the questions you're...
No, it's not that bad, but they're just, you know, and a lot of times I think they're so busy that they don't really know who I am, or, you know what I mean? They just...
Yeah.
They don't have that curiosity, so...
Like, doctors don't have time to read the papers. Like, it blows me away sometimes that doctors, like, I put a paper in front of their face and they're like, I've never seen this before. And I'm like, well, read. Do you not have any time to do the research, like, to learn what you're treating? Like, I don't know. It's a crazy mixed up world. But I really appreciate you being here. And I'm going to put all the information in the show notes below for people to follow you on Telegram and make sure that they subscribe to your room. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah. Make sure I get a link because I definitely want this on my page. I feel like this is one of the best interviews I've done. So
Woo!
I'm so...
Incoming. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.